And we're back for part two of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast, the interview with Niagara winemaker Thomas Batchelder. Part one, I sort of abruptly ended it. I apologize, but it just, when he said the line, "and so we digress," it felt like a good little just cut point there. And again, I was laughing about how I hate when someone will come up to me and tell me a story of about a great bottle of wine that he or she tried. And then I ask them, what was the bottle? They don't remember. I'm like, yeah, it's like you told me you saw a great movie, and I ask you, what was it? You're like, you don't remember, just that it was an action movie. You don't know anything else. So those stories kind of stink. And so in part two, in a second, we get more into Pinot Noir, get more into winemaking, about some of his influences, and, you know, just a lot more from one of the smartest people in the area when it comes to making wine. And, you know, he's been doing it for so long for a lot of very prestigious winemakers and been doing it from all over the world. And I don't think I've talked about this, and if I have, I apologize. I'll keep it quick. But I do still get, and I will for a long time, and I understand why, you know, the comment of, oh, I won't drink a Canadian red. It's too light. It's not my palate. And when I get upset, it's not that I get upset, but it's more like, are you kidding me? Are you really going to just discount all of it? As I've said before, it's not based on some sort of nationalism. It's not based on some sort of, hey, why don't you like what's here? Or, you know, we get a chip on our shoulders as Canadians because we're not Napa or Spain or, you know, or France or Italy. It's more that you're missing out. There's great wines. And the day I did this interview, or later that evening, I went to a consignment event trying a whole bunch of different Burgundy. And these wines held up. Like, I was trying some really good, it was all Premier Cru level stuff. I can't afford the Grand Cru level. And even the Premier Cru, just, you know, you buy little dribs and drabs here and there and try to find your favorite Village level, which, again, another tip there. If you can find a producer you like and, you know, there's a good vintage and you find a good Village level Burgundy, whether it's Pinot or Chard, buy it. Get as much of it as you can and throw it away because Burgundy is expensive. But going through it all, I couldn't help but think about earlier in the day and going through these tastings and, you know, my tastings with Thomas of a bunch of his Pinots and his Chardonnays from a variety of different years from, you know, different vineyards and different vine ages and compared it with the Burgundy I was drinking that night, they would hold up. I'm not saying they beat them all, but they would hold up. They would be in the room. If it was a boxing match, it's not going to be a one or two round knockout. Now, in the end, you might choose Burgundy, and in a lot of cases, you should. Burgundy's the bee's knees of wine. But these wines belong in the conversation. They belong on the same table, and they would belong in the ring. By the way, like all these, you know, like the wine locker rooms, the private wine clubs. I don't know where you're listening to this, but there's a whole bunch of them in Toronto. And the one thing I've always noticed, and I appreciate this, they're always sneaky. You know, they're always hidden. They're always far, you know, they're always behind a very nondescript door. There's no big giant sign saying like fine wine reserve. You know, I've been in the one on King Street or Lombard or the new one in the Yorkville area. And they all have a little bit of, nope, we're going to keep this private. I don't know, to make the allure and make it seem more classy, make it seem more exclusive. I do get it from a practical standpoint. A lot of these wines are hundreds and some of them are thousands and thousands of dollars for just a single bottle. So, you know, it's you know, you want security. It's no different than an art gallery or a bank, really. But it's always a little bit cloaked in mystery, which I think they go for. I think the clientele like it. I don't mind it. I something kind of neat about that. Anyway, enough of me yammering. When you hear this, it'll be released either right before or just after New Year's. And if you want to tweet me, what are you opening? You know, I'm always curious at MCOS 56. Or if you hear this after New Year's, what did you open for New Year's? I'm sort of eyeing some things. I, you know, not a shock. I have an old Burgundy, Domaine du Jacques 2001 that I'm going to open. And, you know, I'll do a little mix of things. I've got a a really cool old New Zealand Chardonnay. And so, yeah, I got a bunch of different stuff that I'm kind of eyeing. But anyway, enough of me. We now go into part two of my interview with winemaker Thomas Batchelder, and we start with how everyone in Niagara seems to be on the same side. They're very collegial. There's not a lot of warring factions. I think everyone wants to work together to try to help elevate the entire region. So we talk about that and we move on to the Pinots. So without further ado, part two of my interview with Thomas Batchelder.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
What are we trying now?
What we're trying now is another thing from Wismer, from the Vineland Bench. I mean, they have 300 acres up there, right? That's like 120 hectares. There's a lot of grapes up there.
Wismer Parkey?
Yeah. You know how you're going to remember it? Mm. We call the Wingfield in our family because this is the wine. The second Chardonnay we tasted is one of the wines that's helped put Batchelder on the map because you twigged to that right away. You didn't want to say it was your favorite. I told you it was my favorite and enabled you a bit.
Yeah.
But why I did that was because whether it's Jancis Robinson or Matt Kramer or any foreign dignitary who's been through here or who we've seen on their own home turf in Chicago or in New York or in London, Canada goes out as a team to market many times to these places, right? A bunch of us go out and we pay our way and we get a little, you know, we get a little subvention. What is that again in English? We get a little help from the state to get there and rent a hall in England or whatever. But they all go to Wismer Wingfield and they see something specific yet of international quality in it, and they all give it great scores. And there's a reason for it. It's because it just is. All I did was find it. I didn't do anything else.
Yeah.
Right? And so in Vineland has a special vocation, as does Jordan, because they're quite far from the lake. Things ripen later and have more flavor. So Wismer Park, P-A-R-K-E, I declassified for 3 years into the Niagara Pinot because it had this overarching gamey flavor that I didn't like. And then I realized that gamey flavor was the signature. So I divided it up and found that the western part of Wismer Park had the gameiest. Let's use a different word.
Okay.
It has the most irony thing. I think it comes from magnesium in the soil. The soils are slightly redder than elsewhere. And I can smell sort of like, sometimes it's a licorice thing, but more often it's an iodine-y thing, a deep... It's only a mid-weight wine. It's a very perfumed wine. We have more perfumed wines than that, but it's a perfumed wine. But it's still a very sort of masculine wine in the sense that it's very irony. And my wife, Mary Delaney, likes to say that it's like you bit your tongue, that kind of iron taste.
Yep.
And you get a little bit
of
blood.
Oh, it's unique.
It is unique.
By the way, one thing I've noticed is it's interesting in Niagara is that technically every winery is its own business. That's right. They're competing with all the other wineries to get the consumer to buy their wine versus another wine. But there really is a camaraderie. Like, we're all in this together. I was driving around. I went to a bunch of different wineries yesterday, and I was interviewing Sue Ann's staff, and everyone loved her. And then I said, oh, later I'm going to be interviewing Batchelder. Everyone said the same thing. Oh, say hi to him. Oh, we're getting together with dinner with him and Mary at the end of the week. Like, it's funny. You're both competing businesses, and yet you are all sort of on the same side.
Yeah, we are. And I've been calling it more and more. We've been working hard. And what we're getting together for is a great Burgundian dinner called La Polée, which is you bring your old bottles at the end of harvest. And Batchelder's hosting it this year. But I'd love Sue Ann's staff. I've known her since the day we moved here. A lot of the Clos Jardin lands were bought from the staff family. And she's such a force of nature and such a lovely, giving person. How can you not love her? But what's happened is over the years, you know, since we moved here in 03 from Oregon, we're Quebecers who moved to Ontario from Oregon. We didn't take the 401, we came by plane.
Yeah.
You know? And it's so crazy, crazy life. But the thing is,
Quebecers from Oregon who came to Ontario.
Yeah. But, you know, one thing we've noticed is there's been this collegial approach that's been developing. And I want to remind people that we're talking about the European idea of colleges. Like, it's not college football I'm talking about. It's where one university had many different colleges, often named for the Saints, you know, and it would be, you know, Trinity College or, you know, at Cambridge has like 20 colleges over in England. And the collegial thing was each college had a sports team or a dining room. Think of Harry Potter. That was one college of a university, you know, in Hogwarts. That's what it would be. And that's what it looked like. And by the way, it was filmed, you know, like in Cambridge, they did know where that college does exist, where the choosing hat was. But my point is that collegial cooperation to advance the industry and advance the understanding of terroir is happening like right now in Ontario. And where it used to be, like, remember, I'm not from here. I'm adopted Ontarian, with very proud.
Yeah.
But so I get to, you know, like if we have a friend in common and we, well, that's Sue Ann Staff. It's easy, much easier to say how great Sue Ann Staff is than for me to say how great Batchelder is or isn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just that you can be objective. It's just a more fair thing to do. So as somebody who's moved here, when I'm effusive about Ontario terroirs, including Prince Edward County and the other regions, I'm being effusive as somebody who's come here and discovered them and is proud of them.
And you don't need to be here. If you wanted to, you could make your bones in Oregon. You could make your bones in Burgundy, which is another, just, I mean, it shows how much you love Niagara. And I know it's something that you struggled with a couple of years ago about how much focus do you put on Niagara. And it speaks to just how excellent the terroir here is that you've focused a lot more of your energies here. Just, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day than what is going to be in Burgundy and Oregon. So it's also a compliment to this area, the fact that this is where you want to be.
That question was like, for instance, one of the things that has happened to us with Batchelder is, and we're going to get back to the collegiality of it here. One of the things that's happened with Batchelder is I really thought that our Oregon wines would be loved on the West Coast and our Burgundy wines would be loved in New York and Montreal, uh-huh. and that Toronto and the LCBO would be pretty much middle of the road because they love their out West wines and they love their French wines. And of course they support Ontario. What has happened is everywhere we go, people only want Niagara. And I've been like the anti-visionary because I couldn't see it coming. They always...
No one could. I mean...
That's the emptiest warehouse is Ontario all the time. And it's not just because of local people.
And the remarkable thing about that is just one thing I've discovered doing this pod and just being in wine for a long time is that people always say, for instance, it's easier to sell BC wine to BC people than it is to sell Ontario wine to Ontario people. Yet your experience, which I find refreshing because I like different, is that your Niagara is being snapped up more than Oregon and Burgundy, even though Oregon and Burgundy, they got a lot more press clippings internationally than we do here in Ontario.
So I'll tell you why I think that is. And I can answer both sides of that question.
Curious.
And I think this is key. You've got to remember that the LCBO is one of the biggest buyers in the world. The SAQ is another one. The two biggest wine producing countries in the world are France and Italy, but they only drink their own wines.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the exceptions so prove the rule. So what do you have here? You have generations of Ontarians that grew up drinking wines from away and Canadian wines, which were less good then. But even the good ones had a hard time getting through. Why? It's not the fault of the LCBO. That's what we weren't a producing country. Now, England was not a producing country, but they now are. But the
thanks
same
to climate change.
Yes, and the same thing happens, and because they do mostly bubbly too,
yeah. right?
And the Gulf Stream. But I mean, the point is that New York City still has trouble supporting the Finger Lakes. So the great wine markets of the world, first the English, they were the first. And then New York City, Montreal, and Toronto, these are the great importing markets. You know, now Germany imports a lot of wine because they don't make a lot of red, but nowhere on the scale of what we all do. We have 7 million consumers here. It's the biggest, you know. So, I mean, this importation thing, which is great, I love my imported wines. I don't want the LCBO to stop doing that. But we developed our industry after there was something already in place. And it's very humbling. Quebec did too, but their industry is much smaller. Now, I was tasting Quebec wines last week, and they're fantastic. But I mean, and English bubblies are fantastic, and they're very expensive, you know? They're like £45 for a starting bubbly, but they're on the same chalk seam that comes under the channel from to Dover from Champagne. So they have every right to be able to do that. They're at a similar latitude. But their market has every wine in the world in England, you know, in London. And so they have too much to compete against. But what's also happening, so that was the background. And that's why our parents were like, Canadian wine, Well, because they had an alternative. The French can't go French wine, because that's all they have. They just, they can diss a region and find a better region they like. But here, what's happening now is that as the world moves away from wanting, I'm not even going to talk about climate change, which is pretty obvious, but as the world moves away from wanting 15% wines, 14, 5% wines, and actually the sums today are asking for 12.5 wines. That's what we get in Niagara. That's what Prince Edward County gets, you know? And so we just get that naturally. So a wine, a grape that hangs on the vine for a long time and gets more flavor, we've already said that, but comes out of that process at only 12.5 potential.
Yeah.
That is dialed into the human digestive system.
Oh, that's it.
In a way that 15%
interesting.
Isn't.
That's really interesting.
And that acidity helps you digest.
Yeah. Because if you let the grapes linger in a lot of other parts of the world, you're going to get 14, 14.5, 15, sometimes even higher. So you're right. Here in Niagara, you can get the development of the fruit, but without, because there's nothing worse than the high alcohol wine. Thought about what we're drinking now. What I appreciate about the Vizsma Parki.
The Wiz. Like the Wiz of Wizard of Oz?
Yeah.
So at home, we call Wismar Wingfield. I digress too much. At home, we call Wismar Wingfield that has gotten so many people turned on to Niagara Chardonnay.
Yeah.
Abroad, like Tokyo. Like, we send small amounts abroad, but it gets great notice. Wismar Wingfield, that is the only one we call the Wiz. There's Wismar Park, there's Wismar Foxcroft, there's Wismar Foxcroft Gamay. But the Wiz is Wismar Wingfield. So if you can't remember the pronunciation, folks out there, just remember it's the Wiz, like the Wizard of Oz.
Anyone who listens to this podcast knows I average about 10 to 15 mispronunciations in every podcast I do. It is shameful.
It's part of your charm.
God, I hope so. The one thing that, you know, really surprised me about this Pinot, as you mentioned, it's mid-weight at most. You know, it's light to mid-weight, but there's a long linger.
Yeah.
The finish lasted longer than I expected when I was first trying the wine.
Well, this is 2017, by the way. The two Chardonnays, as you said, were 2015. We showed Chardonnays showing terroir with a bit of age, and now we're showing unreleased Pinots. These Pinots are going to be released at Batch Elder's 2nd of April release, which is going to be called the Violette release because it's Violette's birthday. We hope to do it every year on that time. And these will be fuller and rounder then. Remember, wine in the bottle always develops. So the 17 Pinots are not coming out till April 2nd. What we're offering these days right now are the last of the 15s and some 16s.
I want to buy a bottle of that Wingfield Shard when we leave.
Okay, well,
there's any left?
I think there's a little left. By the way, all these wines. This is something your readers, your listeners need to know is to make wines like this, you can't make more than 4 to 8 barrels of them. And here's why. First of all, the grape vineyards, especially the older vines, aren't that thick on the ground in Niagara. So I'm working really hard to try to get more under the Batch Elder, in the Batch Elder cellar. And once you get them, okay, you need to, if you've got 12 barrels of something, you need some of it for that wine that goes out to the LCBO just called Niagara. It's still a $25 or a $30 wine, and it's made with the same care. But keeping just the most harmonious barrels with the least background noise, to use a metaphor, okay, with the least background noise, that helps define a single vineyard. If you have 10 barrels of wine and you put it all out as a single vineyard, it'll be a less clear message because there'll be something in one of those barrels, whether it was some press wine, whether it was slightly too oaky, whether it had some slight funk. All those things are lost in a bigger blend of 30 or 40 barrels. But when you drill down to the best 4 to 8 barrels in a lot, you can really have a clear message, which is what we do. The other barrels make the Niagara wine, the Niagara blend, better.
Yeah.
So there's, when you buy one of our Niagara wines, you've got like our best vineyards in it, just not my favorite barrels. So there's a real parsing work going on in quantifying things. And this Wismer Park was 5 of our best, most bloody barrels. It tastes like steak tartare, if you know what that tastes like. Well, without the spice.
Yeah.
You know.
So I'm going to ask now the biggest, I mean, there's a bunch. And by the way, we're not going to get to everything. And this interview is going to be a two-parter, because usually I cut it off around 53, 54 minutes. This is going to be a two-parter, which is fantastic. I still got some more time. When newer listeners or people are getting into wine, when they hear the term, and you hear this all the time, when you're in California, everyone says, oh, we make our wines in a very Burgundian style. And then you try it, and like, this is a big fat wine that tastes like it's 30% Syrah. And you're like, liar, liar. But every place you go, every rep at every wine tasting room always says, our wines are more Burgundian. What does, when someone says our wines are Burgundian, what does that actually mean? And again, I know this is one of those sort of big picture questions that's hard to fully answer.
I love your questions, man. You come with so many thoughts already prepared that you make this so easy. One of the things is those people are actually speaking the truth, although it's fun to call them liars, and I might too. When you have that Pinot that tastes like it's 30% Syrah or whatever, that's just a region that's too hot to do classic Pinot as we know it.
Mm-hmm. I had some of the Costa Browns, for instance.
Right.
I used to love, my palate changed. I used to love Costa Brown, and then I woke up one day, I opened a bottle, I tried it, I'm like, this is a well-made wine, but this is not Pinot Noir. It's a blend.
So you know how Canada, we went from being this largely Anglo society, white and Franco in Quebec, mm-hmm. and Anglo or like Eastern Europe in the prairies or Sweden or all the things that made up, along with the Autochtone indigenous, the original Canada, and how we become one of the best, most accepting nations. And we've profited so much from all the diversity in our country and,
yep.
and the peace that we live within, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like we've learned to accept those things. So I have had to learn to accept different expressions of Pinot Noir. So this is what I would say to your listeners. I had definitely the same reaction as our host. I've Costa Brown has been at many of the international Pinot Noir celebrations out in Oregon. We're buddies with them. But it's such a different expression of Pinot Noir, just like there are many different expressions of Canadianism that we accept and we honor and we're actually really proud of now. So what I would say is, if I'm in California especially, or anywhere in the States, and my host says, I have got an incredible Costa Brown, mm-hmm. or any other good California wine, they're usually $100 a bottle, and they set me up right, don't set me up with 3 Burgundies and then pop that. Give me a lesser California, then a really good mid-California, and lead me uphill to the Grand Cru, and I'll be, in French we say, à genoux, I'll be on my knees with gratitude. However, when my own dollars are to spend, I'm going to buy Burgundy or Niagara or cooler New Zealand or, you know, or places that are making. It's easier to see the terroir differences when it's cooler, when it's a cooler climate. Why? There's an actual reason. There's actual reason for French oak over American oak. We can get to that later. The reason for cooler climates is that Pinot Noir is a thin skin grape. And the... Hey.
Is this about tea?
Yeah, well, let's break it.
Sure. We'll break for a sec.
No, it's okay.
What people need to know, I'll stop this in 1 second, is that Thomas is a very, very busy man. He took 100 calls before we got started, so we will pick it up in 1 moment. And we are back. Thomas is dealing with one of your Coopers, and you've poured. Before, just real quick, because only about 10 or 12 more minutes. When someone says our wine is made Burgundian, what does that mean in the vineyard? What does it mean in the winery?
I remember I went to La Massa in Chianti, and they said to me, you know, our wine's made in a Burgundian style. I'm like, you're pure Sangiovese. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And what it means is Burgundy, along with the Rhine and Mosel, that They are the originators of the single vineyard approach. One grape and then single vineyard. So it's not a blended region. It's a region that you use, make single vineyards from. And so the Burgundian approach is to look for geological and geographical, topographical things that might make a vineyard different from another, and to celebrate that, okay? And so what I was saying earlier is, in a cool climate region like Niagara, the Pinot Noir already has a thin skin. That's why it rots. And that's why we have sorting tables, so we can make good wine every year, or great wine every year. But when it's in a hotter region, the Pinot Noir makes a thicker skin. So it's not as easy to see the terroir, which is what you said earlier about Costa Brown. Although we love Costa Brown.
They've made some great wines in the past. I have a bunch of their older stuff, which I've been really enjoying if I let her decant for a couple hours.
So what's happening is the Burgundian approach is the approach that says, I'm not a winemaker as a signature. I'm a winemaker who tries to make the local geography and terroir sing through the wines. So you make choices in the vineyard, in your fermentation, and in your barrel choices that don't obscure the wine with makeup. So there is an intent to let the soil pass through into the glass. So even in warmer places like Australia or South Africa or California, when they do all their single vineyards with a Burgundian approach, they all taste different. If you just take one of them out of context, yes, they're much heavier than Burgundy or Niagara.
Yeah.
They would find our wines light. But it's a cultural thing, and it's literally a cultural thing both for our minds and where they're grown. So Burgundian approach means single vineyard focus and a light touch from the winemaker that doesn't obscure things with oak or too heavy maceration. Remember that maceration is like making tea. When you put 4 tea bags or loose tea in a pot and you put really hot water, are you leaving it 1 minute, 2 minutes, or 10 minutes? That's the maceration part.
Yeah.
And you have to do that in a style that lets the vineyard shine through. That's the shortest answer I got.
No, I know. And I wish, by the way, because we're going to be ending this soon, here are things we didn't get to, but I'm going to want to talk to you at some other time. The difference in you as a winemaker now versus when you got started, climate change, everything you're doing, you're back doing stuff with Closure Dane. It's like doing a sequel, but we're not going to have time for it because I want to talk about Carl Kaiser, the impact he had on Canadian wine, and this incredible Lowry Vineyard 2017 Pinot Noir. This fella sings.
I know, and this is a... I mean, we're not going to say this in the future because Canada will be known, but this is our Volnay or our Chambol. Mm-hmm. So right behind you on the wall, there's a tribute to Carl Kaiser and called the Grandfather of Canadian Winemaking that was in the newspaper. And by the way, our whole reception room has things not only about Ontario, which might seem funny, but it's all the places we've lived in the world, where, as we said earlier, maybe we didn't choose to live or we agreed to live, and it's enriched our lives. And one of the people who've enriched my lives the most as a mentor is Carl Kaiser. So I never thought I'd work in Ontario because he had the only job at Inniskillen that was a Pinot Noir job back in the day. And after wine school, I visited him, and prior to wine school, and was inspired by him and asked him what I should plant in Quebec if I could start my own vineyard. And one of the things that was done for him, so he was a big mentor, and one of the things that was done for him, that he did, was he started something called Alliance, or Alliance, and it was like an Opus One project that was between Mondavi and Rothschild. With Jafflin in Burgundy, he did Alliance or Alliance. I remember coming up to Toronto to buy that from Quebec because it was Niagara's limestone soil from the Lowry Vineyard, later on from the Montague Vineyard. And what he did was he picked from the oldest rows in those vineyards that were quite young at the time and made a beautiful wine that the French Bernard Rapolte of Jafflin brought over French barrels. And they came up with this amazing wine that was really expensive. It was $35, but that was like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the rows that were planted for him were Pinot Noir at the Lowry Vineyard. That vineyard is now today a winery, and it's called Five Rows because of that moment. But of those five rows, Wes Lowry doesn't use all the fruit, and he sells batch elder. A couple of tons. And what you're tasting right now is mostly 84 plantation with a little bit of 88 plantation. So there's two people in the world. I mean, Carl Kaiser started it. Five Rows, you got to buy their wine, talking about the collegial approach. Five Rows is a little boutique farm winery making amazing stuff, but they still sell grapes. And they sell to Batchelder every year. They sell to Leaning Post. They sell to Adamo. They used to sell to Creekside. And Creekside said to me, Craig McDonald, who now runs the Peller winemaking, and Rob Power, who's at Creekside, said to me, do not over-macerate Lowry. Now that you've got it, it's a gem. It's a bijou. If you over-macerate it to try to get color, you'll get something acerbic. Do you know that's the first wine in the New World, including Oregon, where somebody gave me some feedback on how to make it? In the Old World, the vineyards are known. You can buy the same vineyard from somebody else. You can talk to the vineyard manager with the plot next to you and say, how should I vinify this? Because the vineyards are all contiguous in Burgundy. This is the first example. I might have never got this vineyard, but Rob Power and Craig McDonald, great local winemakers, one Aussie, one Canadian, said, do not over-macerate. Let it be light. Let it be your ballerina. And that's what we've done. Very little or no new oak every year. Mm-hmm. And just let this sing. It's perfume. It's rose petals.
Yep.
But it's massive in the mouth.
It's massive in the mouth. It's a nice dance of... There's a little bit of spice, a little bit of tomato leaf, a little bit of... the red fruit profile, a little bit of dark cherry. Like, there's a lot going on
cherry.
This fella.
You've got this. You've described it. And so... While, we're going to do more and more stuff. Now that we have our retail permit, it's like a permit to grab some things. So we're going to grab this Lowry Vineyard in one barrel of only the 84 plantation. One thing I'd love to do, while we still have some time, is go back, just as we did with the whites. Let's go back to the Wismer Park.
Yep.
And see what we get here. Now the irony bit should really pop out for you there, Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, I got so much to tell you about Kalis and how fabulous we're doing there. And the new winemaker, I'm the consultant, Kelly Mason is not the new winemaker. She's been a force of nature since we started Kalis almost. I started in 2010 and she came on in 2013. So much to tell you about La Clos Jardin coming back in a smaller size, but in a super intense way. But that's for another time.
You're right. You don't want to use like that blood iron thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. And you say that and people are like, oh, that's gross. No. Just the same way farmyard or barnyard or, earthy notes aren't bad. You're right. They're so different. Those two.
And they're made the same way with the same barrels. And I don't like saying saline about the Foxcroft either because people may get the wrong impression. We're just trying to find metaphors to describe these, right? And if you don't like the things of bloody or you don't want to hear things like that, if you think of charcuterie made out of duck, like duck breast, smoked duck breast, that's in there, or just the darker prosciuttos and stuff like that, or the sausages, you get that feeling. That's what's in this wine. And people may be listening and saying, well, can that be pleasant?
Yes. 100%. We're out of time. This has been more than pleasant. Tell listeners, not that you really need to plug. It's not like you have this huge store of wine you're looking to sell. But for people that want to learn about wine, people want to try excellent Pinot, excellent Chardonnay. Just where do people find you? Where do they find Batchelder?
So, yeah, we just got our retail license and we're online at batcheldeniagara.com. We're only ever going to go out with like 500 cases a year.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're committed to export. Like, you have to understand, this is a life energy, it's a life project that Mary and I are doing. We want Wismer. Wismer Park is in London, right? Wismer Park's in Ireland. It's tiny amounts. It's not going to move the needle in a mass market way, but there's people having that in Irish country houses turned into inns going, what is this stuff?
That must feel great.
It does feel great, but we have to get Canada on the map now. And if I could, so Batchelder, it's called Batchelder Niagara, our site, and you can sign up and get the releases. And the idea is we're overcommitted, we're overworked. We love what we do. We love going at a fast pace, right? But the thing is, we can't stand in our own tasting room. We can't do it. We just don't have the time.
Yeah.
I only get about 20 weekends off a year, so I want to keep sort of most of them. You can book an appointment and we'll come in on a weekend and meet you for sure. But I mean, the point is not to stand here waiting for customers. Can't do that.
No, you don't have time for that.
I have to paint my garage door sometimes. You know, yeah. I have to change my winter tires. We love what we do, but we just can't be here all the time. So, I mean, you can figure out, you know, Batch Elders and Beans will roll up here. There just won't be anybody here.
Yeah.
With just a bunch of 300 barrels sleeping.
Call ahead of time is what you're saying.
Yeah. So you can see that at Batch Elder Niagara. They show you how to get for, we're just launching that website. They'll show you how to get to get an appointment. We're going to be starting in January doing that. So we're really excited about that.
Thomas, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
And thanks for coming down and following me around on during the winemaking.
Yeah, it's great.
Like I said, whatever I said might have been good, but I'm sure you learned way more because you know a lot about wine by osmosis.
It's fantastic just shutting up and listening and watching. We'll have to do we'll have to do a part two of this sometime in the near future.
Yeah, let's do it and come and taste the new wines you saw as juice.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.